Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey, coming to you live or not so live from Japan. And today we're doing a special crossover episode. It is Axe of the Blood God Cross 8-4. And we have three people on this show. We have, first up,
I'm Mark McDonald.
I'm Justin J.J. Epperson.
Roy Blakely.
And we're here ahead of Bit Summit, which starts on Saturday. It's Japan's indie game conference.
Yes.
But we're going to talk about a whole bunch of subjects RPG related. We're first going to talk a little bit about E3 and some of the things that happened there because Mark was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to continue on to Fire Emblem Awakening, which you guys actually worked on because aside from hosting a very popular podcast, you are also a localization studio.
Yes.
That's right. Podcast in air quotes and
right.
localization studio in air quotes. But yes,
popular.
We try.
Popular, not in air quotes. We're actually very popular.
Underlined. Are we? Okay.
Bolded.
Well, good. That's news to me.
Yeah.
That's good news.
Yes.
And we're going to finish up with kind of the challenges of RPG localization. But,
cool.
So the first thing we're going to talk about, E3.
Yes.
Kind of one of the narratives that kind of came out of E3 that I found interesting was that Japan had a really good E3.
Mm-hmm.
And being as you guys are actually in Japan and you're heavily plugged into the game community, I was wondering, what's your perspective on that and like how accurate do you feel that is?
I think in terms of, it was kind of a perfect storm, in terms of the new exciting announcements, like you take the Sony press conference, which most people think is like the big memorable standout kind of moment of E3, and there were three, I think, really big announcements there, surprises to most people. One, leading off the show with The Last Guardian, finally, Fumito Ueda's.
Sure.
Game, which everybody has been waiting for forever, Japan-produced game. Then you had the Shenmue 3 Kickstarter, Yu Suzuki, original developer, out there developing it here in Japan. Of course, that's like a long way off, you know. Last Guardian is pretty closer, but also probably a long way off is finally Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Yay. Finally Fantasy VII Remake.
There you go.
Yeah.
Which is also, being a Japanese IP being made in Japan and fitting perfectly with the podcast, big RPG. A lot of people's first RPG, a lot of people's last RPG, JRPG especially.
Right.
But I would say so. I mean, almost to the point where, you know, Metal Gear was there, but not being pushed too heavily because they were not attending E3 and who knows whatever's going on with Kojima. But, usually the last couple years, besides Nintendo, which for some reason I don't count, a lot of people don't count because Nintendo games are all Japanese.
It is kind of weird, though, because, you know, even though most people will say that Nintendo just totally screwed up this E3, that they can still say that Japan, like, had a strong presence because...
Mm-hmm.
Usually, like, Nintendo is the Japan presence.
Yeah, the last couple of years, right? You'd be, like, lucky if there were one or two other major tentpole titles. You know, maybe Platinum would have something
right.
or something. You know, Platinum had, like, I already lost track of how many games
right.
they had announced at the show as well. They had Transformers, a bunch of other stuff that they were working on. I think it was, like, four projects that people were counting up. But, I would say it was... A kind of Japan had a couple years of maybe building stuff, and then now there were a couple cool announcements. Or for some of the things like Final Fantasy VII, who knows what state that's in, but I'm guessing that that's like a long way off just from, you know, the first time you hear about these games, and by the time they come out, they're usually pretty old. But, much less you have your Kingdom Hearts, you have your other things that are there kind of year to year, not really surprises. not really. Then Nier 2, yeah, good point. Like Square Enix had a pretty strong press conference of their own. A lot of that was Eidos stuff, sure, but yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with that. I think people
Persona 5.
Yeah,
that's but that true. Wasn't really there.
It's true. Yeah. It Dance was. All Night was there though. That people were dancing. Oh.
I saw videos. I saw videos.
Yeah, I don't want to see those videos.
So much Waja.
I just walked past it a couple times. That's as far as much as I got. But yeah, I think that's true. That was good. I mean, a lot of people I think didn't even notice it. You know, there was just like Shenmue, Last Guardian, Final Fantasy. They're also all known entities. So a lot of people weren't really thinking about it or calling it out. But if you do sit down and think about it, I do think it was a strong show, especially relative to the last couple of years. You know, it would have just been a normal E3 around the turn of the century. But these days, it was actually really strong.
This isn't, admittedly, it's not an RPG. Or no, actually, it is an RPG by all accounts, Horizon.
Zero Dawn.
In fact, in RPG, they had numbers like flying over their heads.
Western Monster
Hunter.
Which
means that I can totally talk about it.
Yep.
What is your perspective on kind of these Western games co-opting so much of the Monster Hunter elements, especially given that Monster Hunter hasn't really been that popular in the U.S.? Mm. I mean, it's done all right.
Right.
Monster Hunter 4 it's really growing. Caught on in a way that I have not seen any of the other games catch on.
Indeed, yes.
Mostly because it was on the 3DS.
Yeah. Yep.
But what is your kind of perspective on these Western developers, and in this case a European developer, kind of co-opting these elements?
I think it's about time.
Yeah. Maybe they've played Monster Hunter and they're like, this has an appeal. Maybe I can repackage it so that it's more palatable for Westerners.
Yeah.
So let's make it HD. Let's make it like you're fighting robots because, you know.
I mean, I think it's great. Like, would we have gotten, you know, Mass Effect without Final Fantasy VII? I mean, there's other great series and things evolve out of these Japanese formulas. You know, if you go back to
Did you just say, would we have gotten Mass Effect without Final Fantasy VII?
Yes.
What's the connection there? I'm not seeing it.
So like a lot of the RPGs, if you speak like by decade or whatever, right? Like a lot of the early PC RPGs, the Japanese creators grew up playing those, and then they started making like the Dragon Quest and the Final Fantasy VII and stuff like that. And then there was like a period where console RPGs, just Western console RPGs, weren't even a thing, right? Like 16-bit Western console RPGs, like what was there? Even into like PlayStation 1, like who, Legacy of Kain, maybe, you know, people started messing around with things.
So you're saying that Final Fantasy VII made console RPGs viable?
I think Final Fantasy VII was, yes. Final Fantasy VII was the game where people said RPGs can be a AAA console title. Like, it can sell huge, massive numbers. It can be, you know, a huge thing. And then I think now that's forked and gone to, if you look at, like, the Elder Scrolls games and Oblivion and stuff like that, those are now first person. They're a little more action-y, but they're... but now I don't even know if you think of that now as a... I mean, it is an RPG...
If you don't mind me quibbling a little bit.
Yeah, please.
I would say that maybe the turning point for that was 2004 when Knights of the Old Republic came out. Because when Knights of the Old Republic came out, it came out on the Xbox because the Xbox was so PC developer friendly.
Right.
Which meant that you had suddenly a massive influx of PC developers like Bethesda and BioWare developing for console for the first time. And they were RPG developers.
Right.
And so they came in and they brought in a style of RPG, which to that point had been totally foreign to consoles.
Right.
And Knights of the Old Republic in particular was extremely successful. And that set the stage, in my opinion, for the Skyrims and the Mass Effects of the world.
I see, Mark, where you're getting, like, basically without Final Fantasy VII, the concept of a AAA RPG doesn't exist. But at the same time, I feel like without KOTOR, there's no WRPG on consoles, which is, well, just like we're like way off the topic, but kind of Mass Effect comes from that.
This RPG is this podcast is all about being off topic.
All right,
Yeah. Why did I bring up Mass Effect in the first place?
Because Final Fantasy VII,
But why was I talking about Final Fantasy VII? Just for the remake thing?
Well, no, we had moved on to the game where you fight the dinosaurs.
Yes. So we were talking about Horizon.
Yes.
I think, you know, it's great for people to take elements from games that are good and maybe don't appeal to one territory or the other, right? Like, Japanese creators do it all the time, too. Take elements from Western games. Right. They're being influenced back and forth. So, like, I totally see a huge amount of people that would love aspects of Monster Hunter but can't get into it because of the more off-putting, grindy, kind of just have to dedicate so much time to
it. The fact
that
it's on the 3DS controls.
The fact that it doesn't, you know, it kind of relies on you learning things from other people, which some of us really enjoy, but so it's just going to keep some people out. So, like, you know, being a gorgeous, like, PS4 looking game, I mean, I don't really care for the enemy designs of what they showed. is one of my, like, quibbles with it. But, like, there's no arguing that it technically just looked completely amazing.
I just I like the fact that now, like, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, everybody would look at Monster Hunter and be like, oh, that game sucks. Controls are terrible. I can't hit anything. Why do I have to flex my muscles every time I heal myself?
Right.
And, like, now people are coming along and being like, actually, you know what? They had something here, and it's really cool, and, you know, it's... The reward you get from learning how to play the game is so good that, like, you know, maybe we should borrow these kind of elements, and we're starting to see the fruit of that in the West, which, you know, Monster Hunter has been a viable, popular franchise in Japan for, God, since when I was in college, so over 10 years.
Yeah, PSP days.
Yeah, and now the West is finally catching on. I think it's great. As someone who loves that franchise, I'm very happy to see it.
In Monster Hunter 4, I think they said sold 1.5 million outside of Japan, which is like nothing to sneeze about. Yeah. It's definitely been on the upswing, and it's not into, you know, Oblivion, Fallout, whatever territory. Sure. But, like, for that series, that's pretty damn good.
The difference now between compared to what it was in, like, 2009 or whatever, when Monster Hunter, what was it, 3G or came out. It was so limited by its platforms.
Yeah.
First the PSP, then the Wii. So actually being on a pretty popular and accessible platform in the U.S. Really has helped its, really boosted its appeal.
Yeah, let's just hope they keep going and do, like, something more console related next time.
That is what everybody wants.
That would be nice. Yeah.
Or both, like, keep the handheld thing going and do a console thing. Like, sure. Why not?
Speaking of console development, so one of the things that jumps out at me when I'm looking at the games that came out or that were shown at E3 is that a lot of them are, in a lot of ways, nostalgia projects. So Shenmue, Final Fantasy VII Remake.
Yeah.
Even Last Guardian, to an extent, is, even though it's a new property.
It's so old that it's become its own nostalgia.
It's could be a retro.
But it's based on the appeal of Shadow of the Colossus and Ico, which are, at this point, more than a decade old.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, is this an indication that Japanese console development is on the rebound, or is it just Japanese developers have caught on to the fact that there's a lot of nostalgia for these properties, and so they're putting their resources into making them work?
I definitely don't think Japanese console development is on the rebound.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, more than ever, mobile is king, and it's just becoming more and more like that. I think there are probably people within the companies that still make console games, because, you know, that number is dwindling. That still like consoles and will have these kind of passion projects, but I think, you know, I think it maybe just was a perfect storm this year.
I mean, I think Japanese development was so dominant in, you know, 8 and 16-bit and even into the 32-bit generation that it makes sense that those nostalgia products, you know, remakes and do-overs and spiritual successors are just popular everywhere, and just the fact that the you know, it might be a few more years, you might start seeing more nostalgia for when things shifted over to Western developed franchises and stuff like that, and remakes and things of those early games. You know, some people were wondering if Mass Effect was going to be a remake of the first one, just to bring it back to Mass Effect for some reason, or if that was a new one or something like that. But I think it's getting into that time period where that stuff could happen. But, you know, I think it does make sense that Japan takes making less games in general. They take less risks than they used to. And so as everybody plays it more safe with remakes and spiritual successors or reboots or whatever, I think it makes sense that Japan would have a higher ratio of those than other places as well.
True or false? the PlayStation 4 is doing better in Japan than before. Like, that it's starting to catch on.
I don't have the numbers in front of me. I feel like it is.
I mean, better than before, it's
not saying much.
It's doing better than before, but it was doing atrociously before. You know, games like...
It needs a Splatoon.
Dragon Quest Monsters and... Not Dragon Quest Monsters.
Heroes.
But Dragon Quest Heroes. You know, it really didn't... PS4 did not have many games created and meant to appeal just for Japan, you know, like their Christmas last year when they had their pre-TGS conference right around PAX time. It was like Ubisoft got up on stage and was like, here's like five titles. Yeah. That would never happen, you know, before. That's also where they announced Heroes, and they did announce, you know, I think they showed like a Yakuza game, and they showed a few other games, but it was like, wow, okay, they're really relying on the West now.
Yeah,
Destiny was one of their big titles. I think it was Destiny was the biggest selling PS4 game for a while, which is amazing when you think about it. But it also says that the other stuff really wasn't selling huge amounts of numbers, and part of that is, you know, it's just going to take time for the games to come out, really good games. But also a lot of it was, you know, just like Japan Studios, Sony has been kind of quiet on PS4, more so than they would on normal systems. Square and those guys concentrate on the West a lot more with IDOS and that sort of thing.
I think it's telling that you're still seeing a lot of cross-gen stuff being announced here.
Metal Gear Solid 5 would have been good if it were PS4 exclusive. That might have done something.
That Dragon Quest, what is it called? Dragon Quest, not Diggers.
Builders?
Builders, yes.
Is that it? Just announced.
It was announced while I was on the plane over here.
Yeah. Cross-platform.
And that's Vita, even. Yeah. It's Vita, PS3, and PS4.
It's like, no matter what, you're going to get held back by the Vita or PS3 because people aren't buying the
PS4.
Because
the second that it's on Vita... Or isn't MGS... Or MGS5... isn't that PS4... and it's next-gen exclusive. It's not on handheld or anything.
No,
it's
but
not
it, on it, handheld, it is but PS3.
Right.
Yeah. It is on PS3?
Yeah.
No kidding. Oh, so that means, oh man, then everybody will buy the PS3 version. Right.
So it's kind of it's funny. Like, I think I remember, I forget the numbers for the Ground Zeroes, but I think it sold maybe a little better on PS4 because the people who buy games by and large, well, not by and large, but a lot of them did move on to PS4. It's just a lot of people stopped playing console games, you know? So, then it does become this kind of chicken and the egg thing where it's like, okay, well, do we only put it out on PS4 and push people into buying the PS4, or do we keep making games that also come out on PS3 and not making anybody buy a PS4? But then that becomes a harder and harder thing to continue kind of as time goes on.
Wasn't the last Tales game PS3 exclusive? Like, it wasn't even on the PS4. They announced the PS4 version
about Exilia 2?
Zestria? Yeah, I think.
I'm almost certain that it's PS3 exclusive at this point. A lot of games are Sony exclusive, from Japan at least. Right.
But no PS4 version. That game came out within the last year.
There'll be a Tales game on the PS4.
Maybe there'll be an up-res PS4 version like a year after.
Well, no, I think that got announced, or at least a PC version. I don't know.
Wow.
All right. Anyway, moving on. True or false, I guess, as long as we're playing the true or false game.
Sure.
Persona is the preeminent JRPG.
Now true.
Based on, like, you mean, when you say preeminent, you mean when, like, critically or sales-wise or mindshare?
Global mindshare, design-wise, global appeal.
I'd say it's the only JRPG that people are kind of, like, proud that they play that still is, like, sounds cool. You know what I mean? It's like, these days when somebody says, you know, you play like Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest or something like that, it's almost like a little weird.
They
to
expect
people,
you to
or
have
it's
an
like,
anime avatar.
Yeah. Or it's like, yeah, it's like, really? Like 13? You playing 13 too? Really? Like, you have to really be, you know, into it, or like, you know, it comes with like a caveat or something like that. You know, 14 is kind of a sidestep example.
A good game.
But yeah.
14's a good game.
14, yeah. But
a good traditional MMORPG.
Yeah.
But Persona has like an actual, like, the cool cachet that Final Fantasy definitely used to have.
Yeah.
that I think it doesn't really anymore. And I have to say, like, the new games, I mean, they earn it. Like, the sense of style and polish really well. And what they're doing with those games, like, definitely is, like, keeping it interesting.
I only ask because, like, I said this on Twitter recently, and I got a mixed response. I got some people saying, yeah, no, that's definitely the case. And I got some people saying, you're completely nuts. Like, Dragon Quest owns Japan.
It owns Japan, but nowhere else.
It owns Japan, but...
Well, that's all... I think that gets to what we started with, which is, like, what perspective are you framing it from? Mm. You know, is it, like, what's the most popular thing worldwide? You know, that's clear. But if we're talking about Western perception among, you know, the internet and people online and people who talk about games and stuff like that, it's really shifted.
I was talking to somebody over lunch today, and they were talking about how when they were debuting Persona 5's trailer, that there was a huge crowd in Shinjuku that was there just to watch the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into stores around here, Persona 4 stuff is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Persona 4 anime, for God's sake. Like, it seems like Persona has just kind of seeped in, and it's become, like, actually a bona fide phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. It's not, like, a super huge, like, Dragon Quest style, like, you know, huge thing, but it is, like, pretty much the big JRPG series. Like, it's fans are always, you know, going to buy those games. You'll see it everywhere, and you don't really have a lot of people who don't like it.
It is really hardcore fans, too, whereas, like, Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy have way larger numbers, but, you know, it dilutes down to people who are...
Well, at this point, Dragon Quest is itself a nostalgia project, right? Especially around in Japan.
Dragon Quest has been a nostalgia project, arguably, since Dragon Quest VII. You know, you could very easily definitely say that, but... One of the things they do well is they do drag new people in, you know. Everybody knows what a slime is, too, and everybody, you know, the characters are really iconic. The music is really iconic. It's used all over Japanese TV.
They have those commercials, those car commercials.
Yeah.
Now they're diluting the Dragon Quest brand a little bit, because you had the Dragon Quest Musou game, and you had the Dragon Quest Builders now.
Yes, which I'm excited. The Builders
looks
awesome.
And the Dragon Quest MMO.
Yeah.
True.
10.
But then again, you know, you've always had, like, you know, Monsters and Torneko's Dungeon, and, like, you know, they've had those kind of offshoot games before.
There was Dragon Quest Swords for the Wii.
There was. I actually liked that game.
Yeah, I did too.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah.
That game was a good...
When it worked.
Great concept.
Yeah.
The execution was not perfect, but I was like, man, when they going to put that Wii Plus remote out and they're going to redo this idea and do it right, and this is going to be amazing.
And nobody did.
I was super sad about that. I really liked that game.
Yeah, me too.
Really liked it. I only played the import, but never played the US.
That said, I feel like we're on the cusp of a Dragon Quest XI announcement.
God, it needs to happen.
So we started teasing it, right?
Corey at Anime...
It's going to be an offline...
Japan Expo.
Oh, yeah.
He was like, it's going to be offline, blah, blah, blah. He starts running his mouth.
It'll be, I think, handheld.
Oh, I think it's PS4.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you think that Kingdom Hearts struggles graphically...
3DS? What handheld? 3DS?
That's the thing. They always sell Dragon Quest on the most popular system, even if it's the older one, right? Like, remember what they did with 9, and it really paid off. It worked great, but it was like, the system was old by that point. So I want to see them do it on a current gen on a PS4, but
I think it's telling that the last two Dragon Quest games that have been announced were both PS4 games.
It's gonna be a smartphone game.
No, he said no smartphones.
Thank God.
But, like, so right in the next 4 weeks, Jump has 4 weeks of Dragon Quest, like, you know, surprises or whatever.
Wow.
Yeah, I think we're about
to culminate.
Get DQ11. Yeah.
Finally.
Maybe.
I was going to say that Persona 5, like, part of the reason Persona has been so big is because it's been for want of a Dragon Quest announcement.
Yeah. And Final Fantasy just, like, disappeared. So, like, Persona just kind of creeped in.
Well,
and
Final Fantasy 15 is kind of a thing.
That's true.
It's kind of a thing.
Stretched out over so long that it almost kind of disappears, you know?
It's like, actually going to come out.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
We'll see about
that. Now that they switched directors.
Yeah.
But I... Okay, Persona 5 is my most anticipated game of the year.
All right.
Cannot wait to play that game.
Yeah, I want to play it.
And so in that, like, and I anticipate it more than Dragon Quest XI.
Is there going to be a demo or an early version or anything like that?
I have not heard anything.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes out this year. I kind of, kind of would doubt it.
Okay.
We haven't heard a release date.
I know.
Yeah. So it's just this year. They didn't say fall or winter.
They keep saying 2015.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure it's December, beginning of December.
I tried to get an interview with Atlas and be like, can I stop by Atlas and see Persona 5? I knew that it was a totally a long shot, but I thought I would do it just for the heck of it.
Yeah.
And they were like, they're very, very busy working on it right now.
Yes.
And I'm sure that they're like crunching like hell to get it out in 2015. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Nobody sleeps.
So moving on, let's talk about Fire Emblem Awakening.
All right.
Yes.
So Fire Emblem Fates now out here.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard some interesting things about it.
I wish John was here. He's
some of the controversy.
God, I wish he were here too.
John is
I've heard some controversy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I'm going to wait until the localization is out before I comment on that controversy.
Good idea. Are you talking about the drugging thing?
Yeah.
I thought
that got disproved.
Gaijin Hunter
was that
Adam.
That was disproved.
Yes. Yeah. Well, okay. It put in the larger context. I thought Gaijin Hunter Adam Ivanko actually did a series of posts and put up a video about it, basically translating the entire thing, and it got overblown and taken out of context. There are still some weird parts to it, like somebody does still slip something into somebody's drink without them knowing about it.
Okay.
Which is
doesn't sound good.
Are we talking about different things?
I don't know. Because are there two controversies?
No, we're talking about the drink that turns you not gay.
Yeah.
Right, that one.
Okay. Yeah. So that is the way that it gets summed up, which is actually not what happens in the game.
Right. So for context, there was a big controversy, I think. I'm pretty sure that there was a character who was explicitly a lesbian. Who,
not explicitly, but just got really nervous when she was around, like, pretty girls.
Okay, so she likes girls, and she does not like men, except when she gets but as a female, like, character, like, as a female main character, you cannot romance her.
Right.
You can only romance her as the male, and as the male, you have to apparently, like, drug her, and that, like, turns her straight?
We can get into this, but I only know what I saw of the video. But but basically, apparently, what happens is, the girl, she gets really like flustered around anytime she's around, like other attractive women. You slip her something in her drink that's like a potion that makes her see all men as women and women as men. In the thinking that, okay, she will, like, see them as men and then will be comfortable around them, and then when it wears off or whatever, she'll be like, oh, yeah, okay, this is just, like, an artificial thing. I was fine with them when I can be comfortable around them and blah, blah, blah.
Oh.
But in the course of that, she sees you as a guy and is, let's see. She sees you as she sees you as a girl. Fuck, yeah. I got it all
she
mixed up.
She sees you as
that
a girl.
Sense,
but is that, does that make sense?
That makes sense because she's flustered around girls and you're a guy.
And this is how you romance her as a guy,
yeah. Okay, but she actually feels comfortable around you, and then when it switches back, she's like, oh, actually, like, it didn't matter. It didn't matter if it was a guy or a girl. I fell in love with the you inside or whatever, or something like that. Message! Anyway, but for the full context thing, actually Kotaku had a really good story about it with, like, cultural footnotes and, like, talking about manga and, like, where the, like, tropes came from and what it's playing with in the Japanese context, at least anyway, that people should read. That said, localizing that, like, yeah, I mean, slipping something into somebody's drink under any context is, like, a super loaded thing, at least in the West.
I can't see they have to have changed that.
So we'll see what they do with it. But that's definitely the sorts of things that, you know, when you're localizing a game like this, that gets flagged, and you're like, okay, what are we gonna do about this?
The roofie scene.
I know that you're not localizing Fire Emblem Fates, but can you speak to, like, how you deal with that kind of thing?
Basically what you would do is, hopefully early on, you would flag something like that as like problematic, and then you would. We, in our case, we would talk to NOA first and be like, hey, you guys agree that this is a problem. Yep, they okay, we agree this is a problem. Okay, let's go to the team and either go to the team and say, hey, we think this is a problem. What do you think about how we should change it? Or better, say, here's what the what you'd had. Here's what the problem is. Explain the, like, the context it's going to be taken in. Because normally it takes that. People legitimately don't know and don't see and don't understand that they're pissing people off or hurting right. people's feelings or offending people or whatever. And so you sometimes go into, like, you have to go into depth to explain what you think is just, like, common sense, you know. But culturally, you have to remember, okay, well, I come from this whole context, and I grew up, and I, you know, watch the news in the West and, and read Twitter in the West, in English Twitter and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, and ideally, you also present a alternate way to take it. And it's like, okay, here's something that is going to preserve as much as possible of what the intent of the scene was, but do it in a way that is going to, you know, still be whatever it was supposed to be. If it was supposed to be funny, or if it's supposed to be scary, or if it's supposed to be exciting, or it's supposed to be romantic, or, you know, hits all the different tones that it hits in the Japanese, you try to sum it up. And then it's hard because you can't explain exactly the language you're using in English back in Japanese, so sometimes it sounds kind of ridiculous, you know. It sounds like you're changing stuff just for the sake of changing it, but then that's where a lot of times you just have to rely on trust, you know. For example, how much NCL or the developers might trust NOA, you know. Those guys been working together for years and years and years. A lot of them have history, and so that's where it really becomes important to have the trust of the developers, where they have to, at some point, they have to make a leap of faith and say, like, okay, yep, that's, if you say that that's what's going to get the same intention across, then we'll go with that sort of thing.
Right.
So you guys, we're kind of jumping into localization in general, but whatever.
Yeah.
You guys have worked on a number of RPGs at this point. You guys have worked on the Tales games. Mm-hmm. You've worked on Fire Emblem Awakening. You're working on some other projects. How would you characterize your particular style when you're localizing these games? Like, what are you shooting for?
Well, it definitely depends on the game.
Yeah.
Because, like, Dragon's Dogma was straight up, you know, like, Sarah with bones.
Yeah.
With an E and stuff like that. But Tales and, I think maybe you could say Tales and Fire Emblem were kind of similar, like, RPG styled, like, slightly comedic.
My recollection of Awakening was that it was just kind of having fun with things, and
yeah
the goal, in my opinion, having, like, when I was playing Awakening, was that every character have a really distinct personality.
Exactly. Yeah. So the big thing with that, I mean, a lot of it, sometimes it comes from the client, and so, you know, we get guidelines before we start on a lot of games. Like, here's the tone that we want to hit. Here is, you know, is this going for a mature thing? Is it going for as, like, a character study? I'm trying to remember the notes for Awakening, but
a lot of it's just what's present in the Japanese already.
Yeah. Well, but as you're translating it, though, I remember one of the notes for Awakening was, like, text is part of the reward for the game. So, as opposed to a lot of games where you're just, like, blah, 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 like, hitting through stuff, actually, we want people to look forward to the text as the reward. Okay, I fought, and I'm, you know, my guy's leveled up, maybe I got some items and stuff like that, but also I get to see this conversation between this person and this person, and I know they didn't like this person, and, oh, I really wonder what's going to happen when they talk to that person, or, oh, this kind of budding relationship between these two people, oh, I want to see the next one or whatever. So the text is not something to be, like, rifled through, it's something to be a reward. So you want even just the act of reading it to be fun, even when it needs to be just informative, or just to tell you, hey, this character is a jerk, or this character is whatever, you still want it to be fun. And so we spend a lot of times, you know, coming up with unique ways that certain characters talked. I mean, a lot of that comes from the individuals that worked on it, too. We just had a really great team for that game. But then, like you were saying, JJ, like, it does, the meat and potatoes always comes from the Japanese, and it's always going to be, you know, it's going to start with how good the Japanese is. And, you know, those character traits, almost all of the ones that the people have in English are there somewhere in the Japanese. It's just a matter of turning it up a little bit, and then also playing it up in a way that Western people are going to understand and like react to, I guess, really make them memorable and fun and that sort of thing. So,
yeah.
Do you have any projects that you're particularly proud of, like, and how they came out?
Well, it's, you know, you can't pick your favorite child.
Sure you can.
Oh, okay. All
right.
Well, yeah, I guess, what was it? Zoo, probably didn't like the Zoo game very
much. Zoo Tycoon?
Zoo Tycoon, yeah.
Wait, you said, are you proud of?
No, I'm just saying, like, oh, well, yeah, that was one of our children, too, and we didn't really like that one so much.
Really? I thought that one turned out great.
Did it?
Yeah.
Okay.
You didn't even work on that one. What are you talking about?
I counted the files.
dude, that one turned out fantastic.
I think one that's always going to stay with me is, like, Monster Hunter Tri. That one was just, like, it was one of my first big projects that we all just kind of like hunkered down on and really just did it, and it was came out really funny, really entertaining, and it was like kind of the first it was the first Monster Hunter game we did, and I was a big Monster Hunter fan, and that was just like one of those things where it's like the game you love becomes the game you work on and love and then it comes out and then you're just like, yeah,
that was awesome. Yeah, I think Tri and four, like Monster Hunter, just to go to another thing, like that was something too where it's like, okay, let's make every character really distinct, really fun. A lot of that came from a guy we work with, Brian Gray, who was awesome. We basically said, okay, Monster Hunter up until now is we really like the game, but the writing is kind of a little bit dry. And so
don't mind me breaking in, Brian Gray also worked on Crisis Core, didn't he?
He probably did. Yeah, he worked on a lot of Final Fantasy
stuff.
He's a
long time localization.
Oh, yeah.
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 Oh, yeah.
A lot of Square projects are his.
Yeah. Right. He's worked on us with a lot of stuff as well. He worked on four. He actually worked on Fire Emblem a bit. Yeah, he's working on projects with us now. He's awesome. And he's been doing it for a long time.
Anyway, continue.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, it was the same deal where it was like, let's make it just fun. There's so much text in this game, let's make reading it fun. And so let's play up every character's little traits, you know, like even if they weren't necessarily present in the Japanese, or even if you get a hint of it one time in the Japanese, like let's turn it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Because you lose something no matter what in translation and in localization. You're going to lose something. So, and this is something that I took from Alex Smith.
Yeah.
Is that you turn something up to kind of make up for that little thing, like add something in to make up for what you're going to lose, or else it's going to be worse than what the original. You can't just be slavishly accurate to the Japanese, or else you are going to lose a bunch of fun and flavor, and it's just going to read dry and shitty. Yeah. So, but yeah, I actually was really proud of Dragon's Dogma.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, like things beyond, I would say, like beyond our control, led it to be maybe a little less good of a localization than I feel like it could have been. Like, you know, the pawns say the lines just so often.
Yeah.
And
ice and fire both.
Yeah. Like, some of the voice actors, too, like they actually got a lot of good, very good voice actors, but the like old English accent is something where if you get it, it's awesome. And if the actor doesn't nail it, it's hard to do. It comes off worse than if you wouldn't have tried. Mm. And so there was like a mix of that in there. And
how much control do you have over the voice acting?
It varies on the project. So anywhere from none at all to actually being there in the booth, which is where John is now.
Casting the actors.
Saying like, no, say, you know, that's my dad, not that's my dad. Like, you know, that kind of stuff.
The funny thing is I used to do that kind of thing because when I used to teach English here, I used to do curriculum development, like Japanese English curriculum development. And one of the big things that we did was we did like audio lessons. And so we had to go into the audio booth and have volunteer voice actors come in and record like dialogue.
Okay.
So we wrote the dialogue.
Yeah.
And then they had to come in and actually like record it. And so we had
Japanese people or just like
American teachers from England and the Western countries, whatever.
Right.
So you know all the different ways that people can fuck up something that you wrote that you thought,
correct.
There's no other way to read this than the way that I wrote it. And yet, I mean, sometimes it's literally one word. You can sit there and they're not saying the one word right. And it drives the actor crazy. Like, it's really like, what? Like, saying the word what? There is like, I don't even know how many dozens of ways to say that would sound completely wrong depending on the context. Mm. But yeah, it can be completely maddening, and it can also be like some of the most satisfying when it goes well. Some of the most satisfying work I think you'll do. But
even just the inflection can be kind of weird.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's half of, you know, that's, there's so much. It never astounds me how many different ways there are to read something that you're just like, I don't even need to leave a note about how to read this, because of course they're going to read it, you know, this way, such and such a way. And yeah, and then you get it back and it's just like, they just totally didn't get it. Or sometimes they'll actually make it better, which is even a little more scary, which is like, shit, that's even better than I had it in my head. Like, that's when it really is awesome, when you're in the booth and that happens. Mm.
Fire Emblem Awakening is probably my favorite project of yours.
Oh, nice.
And I say this because... sorry. I say this because the writing, like, really jumps out at me. Mm. And that's a tricky game to localize, because you have to like the characters. Because a large portion of that game... You said the reward is in the text, right? A large portion of that game is you have to like your characters enough that you want to keep them alive.
Yes.
Exactly.
And then you want to put them together, right? Like, half the fun of that game is getting them into romances and then seeing what kind of kid they come up with, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have to have, like, really broad personalities without being annoying.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, and also, you don't want people to overlap, you know what I mean? Like, it's a big cast. I think it was, like, ended up with, like, 30... or maybe even 40 characters.
Yeah, because it's not only the main characters, it's whatever kids they have.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yes. Exactly. And you don't want it to be like, you know, character traits for the sake of character traits. Like, oh, okay, this is the mean one, this is the sassy one, this is, you know, jokey smurf, this is whoever, whatever. You don't want to make them, like, complete caricatures, but you do want to make them memorable. You do want to have the line where it's like, no matter... if the person's name wasn't even on the line, you could kind of tell who had said it, sort of thing. But that game in particular, one of the things that was really hard about that game was also how complicated it could get. Like, okay, who's mom and dad now? And, you know, there was, like, time travel, and it's like, well, wait, what happens when this person is this person's daughter? Is it possible for him to be his son? And, like, does that make him his own uncle? And, like, it was crazy. We had all of these charts.
I had to invent a Excel contraption that would compare all the different possible conversation branches. Like, so you have this one character, and then you would have 16 other conversations in the one file, and you'd have to match and do this. And it was like this huge thing, and then we had to put it all together again. It was like this huge adventure, but it was like one of those like really big hurdles that we had to kind of figure out on our own. That just is like one of those things about that game where I'm gonna always remember it, but at the same time, it's just like when you play it, you don't know how much work goes into it, but that is all really complicated.
There's large bunches of text that are very, very similar. Parts of it are pretty much the same, except for when it can't be or shouldn't be.
There'll be like three lines that are different in that one scene because he's this other character.
Exactly. Like, or, you know, or he's saying this now to somebody that doesn't like, you know, to cook or something. Like, it gets so crazy specific, and all this stuff you have to keep track of, all the different characters. Like, oh, did this character say they liked cats somewhere in the thing before? And, you know, I mean, there's like so many things, different things to keep track of. But that one and Monster Hunter, the most recent Monster Hunter, and Nier probably were probably the ones that we got the most direct kind of shout outs and people saying how much they enjoyed us, which is also awesome. Which is always great. And but we enjoy it when people just like the game and the localization disappears too. Like, we take satisfaction from that as well.
Well, and plus, like, Fire Emblem's reputation, I feel, in the West at least, was kind of at low ebb at that point.
Yeah,
because Shadow Dragon came out,
right, which we also localized.
Also did that one.
And I'm sorry, I don't recall the localization in that one, but I do recall that I did not like it as much as previous Fire Emblems, mostly because of the graphics.
Yeah, that 3D CG crap.
It was a throwback in a lot of ways.
And they got rid of the support system.
Yeah, so a remake of the very first Fire Emblem, and so it was kind of a throwback in a lot of ways. It was definitely not... You know, it was, of course, it was a remake, so compared to the original first one, it was, you know, a lot different. But it didn't feel like a full-fledged Fire Emblem, kind of, you know what I mean? It didn't feel like a big new step in the right direction, which is what I think Awakening was.
Yeah.
Well, Awakening worked, in my opinion, not just because it had a lot of characters that I liked, but because it took elements from across the series and finally put them into one game. It took the stuff from, what was it, Fire Emblem 5? Forgive me, I can never remember the name.
There's been too many of them.
But being able to have kids, like actually get married and have kids, was a logical extension of the support system.
Yep.
And they had already done the Super Nintendo version, but it had been forgotten forever.
Yep.
And so to put that back in, and then in the Fire Emblem, I think it was 7. Yeah, it was 7. The first one that came out in the U.S.
Okay.
Had the kind of the player created character, and even though they didn't play a large role in the story, they served as a player point of view character.
Right.
And I always thought that it was kind of fun to have the characters addressing you as if you were part of the action.
Right.
And that, so in that case, I loved that you could create your own character who was on the field, who played a substantial part in the story and could romance everybody. It felt like a logical extension. I thought you guys did a really good... Not to constantly praise you all or whatever, but I thought you guys did a great job of imbuing the tactician character with personality that I can remember. So.
How'd you like that name, Robin? We were trying to come up with a name that would work in both sexes and not be Chris or Pat or one of the
Well, I'll admit that I kept singing brave, brave, brave.
There you go. That's all right. We'll take that. well, you saw the Iwata Asks, right, where they thought that was going to be the last Fire Emblem.
Yeah,
and so they're we're going to throw everything. This is, if we're going out, we're going to go out with everything we got, all guns blazing. And so they put everything into it because they really thought it was going to be the last one. And I mean, when we take on a game like that, that we love so much and played so much, John in particular is a huge, huge fan. He played through that game, I don't even know how many times.
Right.
You know, there's definitely a huge, you feel this huge mantle, a huge thing that you're taking on, which is okay, we have to do right by this game. We cannot, we have to hold up our end of the bargain because this game kicks ass. And so I think it makes you do a better job. You know, there's no you don't want to cut any possible corner. I mean, that game is just so good. They just had the gameplay goods there. So we just tried to not screw it up on our end.
Right.
So you guys have been making games for a while now, or you've been localizing games for quite a while now. What have you guys kind of learned over the years about localizing games? What is kind of that received wisdom, having worked on X number of projects? Especially RPGs.
Well, one thing that I think a lot of people don't understand is localization, A, is extremely hard work, B, is a lot more expensive than you think, and C, takes a long time.
Yeah, the time-consuming aspect of it.
Mm.
I think deciding kind of the guidelines for the characters early on, and that's not to say that we do that all the time, but I'm reminded each time that we don't how much it hurts. If you kind of know who the characters are and can, because a lot of, on bigger, especially RPGs, they get so big that not one person is writing all of it.
Right.
And so you have to really all get on the same page about who is this person? How would they react? How do they say thank you? How do they say please? How do they, you have to figure all these things out, but not do it in a way where you have, and I'm not talking about having a book where it's okay, whenever this person says thank you, they say this very, strict one-to-one exact thing, but it's just kind of knowing who is this person and then having different people be able to write and edit all with that same kind of image in mind is really challenging. But I think one of the most important things to coming out with a good product at the end is that everybody kind of quote-unquote gets it. They get that, who the Guildmarm is or whatever in Monster Hunter 4. And when I have to edit something that our translator already wrote, I can do it kind of in that same voice still. Or maybe I can make a joke a little bit better, you know, or like turn something that the other person didn't notice. I can be like, oh, you know what, though, she would say it like this, and then just put a little extra touch on it. Yeah, I think that is, the more I do it, the more I figure out it's how key it is to have different people all kind of on the same page.
Yeah, having taken a localization test, I can say that one of the hardest things is to stay consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, item names, like, in the voice of the characters, the style. Yeah. It's really tricky, actually.
Yes, you have to be super OCD.
Roy, like, how long have you been working on localizing games, and what have you kind of learned?
I've only been here about a year,
mm-hmm.
but I would say the biggest thing I've noticed is that consistency. Like, maintaining that is an extreme challenge. It's like your brain has to always be on, and like you have to be kind of looking at every element of what you're reading and like breaking it down. Like, is this right? Why is this here? Does this belong this way right here? You know, that right. kind of mentality. And
it's like the elder tells you to go get like the Black Hammer of Ra or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then you have to be like, okay, Black Hammer of Ra. So is that part of a weapon series that are all of Ra, or is it actually black? Is the item actually black, or is it a line of weapons that are all black and they all have different names or whatever? It's like you can really go down a rabbit hole on a tiny little bit of text, right? Mm-hmm. And pick it apart and be like, okay, is every part of this exactly right? Is it going to be? Is it not going to confuse people or mm-hmm. lose people?
And even going like beyond the text, like, is this person standing in front of you? Are they talking to you on a phone? Like,
yeah.
Is this the right laugh that they use when they talk to me? Like, there's just so many elements that you don't think about until you're controlling all of them.
Right, like with Monster Hunter, right? Mm. When you came on and we were working on that, I mean, a lot of it was keeping track of how different people laugh.
Yes,
right?
I
like,
remember that.
People consistently laugh like guahaha,
yep.
or other people laugh like hee-hee-ha, or, you know, everybody had a laugh that they had, and, like, there would be exceptions about, you know, in special cases, but just as their normal laugh, they need to be consistent with themselves. And so that's one of the things that you just learn to kind of watch out for.
Mm.
Can you give us a hint as to what your current project is?
I think we can say it's huge. And I think we can say that John has been in America recording voices for 2 months almost.
Yep.
So there's a lot of voice work in it. I think we can say that it has a pretty hardcore group of fans that hopefully will be happy that we're working on it, kind of if and when we can talk about that that we're working on it. But that's our one. We have one big mega project that is Japanese into English, and then we're also working on a bunch of other little things and some English into Japanese stuff. But I think your listeners will definitely be, once it gets announced that we're involved with it, I would definitely want to hear what your listeners think about it.
Mm.
And then when it gets out in the wild, for sure, get their feedback. It's hard. I mean, once projects get to a certain size and scale, that's something with this project that we're definitely reminded, like, of the challenges of once you get past a certain size, you need almost another layer just to keep track of everything. But we're going into crunch pretty much now, so we'll see how that how that turns out.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm sitting in your office. You guys are not a huge team. Like,
no. That's true.
Like, less than a dozen people.
That's right. And we have, that's in the office, though. One of the things that is really awesome is we have a group of people that we work with outside the office. And so we can tailor it per project. So, you know, if we have something that's an RPG, then we have an RPG even from a particular person who makes RPGs. Then it's like, okay, this is the guy who should be on this. This is the group of translators. These are the four translators we should have on this. Or maybe it's the one translator or whatever. But we can pick and choose. Okay, this is an action game. This guy loves this series, blah, blah, blah. We're a big believer that being into the project is going to turn out with a better product.
Totally.
So we can basically tailor the team outside of it. This project, I think we have, I mean, between us and the client that we're working with, I mean, I don't even, it's got to be over dozen people directly working on it with us, and then on their side probably, you know, maybe six or seven, and then at the developer, I don't even know how many. I mean, it takes a village, let's put it that way. But we also believe in keeping the team as small as possible, because of that thing I was talking about before, getting people on the same page and vibing and getting the same character is really hard. Mm. And so the more people that you add, the more translators that you add, the more you increase the chance that people are going to get disconnected. You want everybody to know as much of the game as possible. And if you have a team of like 30 people that, oh, I'm just translating the, you know, NPC dialogue in this one village, I don't know who anybody is, I don't know anything about the world or whatever, you end up with a much worse product. So we try to make it worth people's while to really get into the game and know the game really well. And also one thing on Fire Emblem, I just wanted to give a shout out to a guy named Alan Avril, who basically just was a huge workhorse on Fire Emblem. So he was one of the common denominators of just looked at, I think he looked at almost all of the dialogue. I did a heavy pass on the main scenario, but Alan was the guy on a lot of those conversations, and a lot of what people really fell in love with the characters and stuff like that was absolutely Alan, really spinning gold. And he's a writer. He used to work for Nintendo Power. He worked for the Treehouse for a long time. He actually worked on Hotel Dusk. Was one of his like favorite games that he worked on.
Did he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's a badass and a really good guy. And
he's ours, damn it.
Yeah. Don't poach him. But he does also have a book called Beautiful Land, and he won the Amazon Award for best fiction writer.
There's a plumber with my name in it, and that.
Is book. There? Yeah, that's right. I think he named some characters after those different people. But if you anyway. Check that out. Look at the free thing on Amazon. If you like it, buy it. I think you can get it for like, you know, a dollar or like 50 cents or something. But send Alan a note about that or about Fire Emblem. He's I think Frodo Mojo on Twitter.
Yeah.
He'd love to hear from you.
All right. Plug some stuff.
Other plugs. What else we got?
8-4 Play is a podcast about Japan, Japanese games, and
you messed that up. Japan games and Japanese games.
Yes,
that's why I host the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
No, actually, I'm not going to be hosting it today, which I'm very excited about.
Well, just for the beginning.
No, for the whole thing.
Oh wow!
I just decided.
good job, Thomas.
So, yeah.
I'm going to be on the next episode. It's going to be great.
That's right.
Yeah, we're literally recording it after this episode.
Right.
Bit Summit, depending on when you hear this, happened in Kyoto on July 10th and 11th, I think.
You can find our coverage 12th. Over on US Gamer. This podcast is coming out after the show.
Cool. So yeah, definitely check that out. You're doing a lot of cool stuff while you're here.
I think so.
There's going to be some Twitch streams and stuff like that that you can see archives of. We really... trying to support Japanese indies because they really need it.
Mm-hmm.
We got, if you happen to live in Japan, hey, buy Rogue Legacy. We brought out the Japanese version not that long ago. It's pretty awesome localization, if we do say so ourselves. And what else?
Pretty funny.
Twitter.
I am SPRSK. You can follow me on Instagram, justin.everson. I'm doing that now.
I'm at MarkMacD.
I'm at Kotori.
And, of course, you can find me on Twitter at @_catbot. Check out our Twitter feed over at USGamerNet. Also, go to our Twitch stuff, our Facebook, whatever. It's all USGamerNet. And, of course, if you want to complain at me or maybe give me positive feedback, drop me a line at
nice things.
cat.bailey@usgamer.net. And, of course, leave a comment in our show notes over on USGamer.net. But in any case, that's the end of our show. And...
July is a JRPG month,
right? I was
going
to say, yeah. Wow. It's Anne Lee started that at Chick Pixel.
So get out there and play a JRPG. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to pick up Final Fantasy V again if I have more time. Yeah.
I'm playing Persona Q, and it is awesome.
Nice.
I'm going to be playing that game forever because I keep dying in it. But in any case, yeah.
All right.
What are your guys' July JRPG?
I haven't picked one yet.
Boo.
Final Fantasy VII.
There you go. Okay, that's right. You are playing Final Fantasy VII. Cool.
But for Mark and JJ and Roy and myself, thanks for listening. Happy adventuring.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil.